Well, I was asked, as the schedule indicates, I was asked to just give some comments about the importance of Ralph Rako's foreign policy revisionism. Now, if you haven't noticed, we've put out a couple of new books by Ralph Rako and edited by both myself and Edward Fuller. What we did is we took some Ralph Rako lectures and we added lots of footnotes, hundreds of footnotes to his lectures to provide people with a lot more context and background and the original source material that he was using. And part of this was because we felt that although Rako has many excellent articles, we felt that we wanted to really add some longer and more robust works of his that had been presented in lecture form, but now are in book form. And so check those out in the bookstore if you get a chance. And the one, and I'll be drawing from all of those in what I'll be talking about today, as well as Great Wars and Great Leaders, which is another great book that we have downstairs by Rako, edited by Rako himself. Covering a variety of topics in foreign policy. And the value of Rako to this organization, he was one of our senior fellows for many years, is that as a historian, he really covered a lot of topics related to diplomacy, to war, to foreign policy, to really the machinations of states behind their foreign policy. And that's what we're going to talk about a bit today. Everything that I quote today, even if I attribute it to an author other than Rako, those are quotations that he used in his own writings. And so I'll either be quoting him or quoting people that he quotes so that by the time the talk is over, you have a sense of a lot of the topics and the arguments that Ralph is making. And it will just give you some more familiarity with his own work on historical revisionism. Now, he explicitly endorsed the project of revisionism. He thought it was important, and that's why we put this quotation here in the schedule. It has Rako saying, "Revisionism, as it pertains to historical interpretation, is an absolute necessity. Without revisionism, we end up believing the propaganda that a state involved in a war always puts out and always tries to spread." And he called for more historians to work on revisionism. And what he meant by revisionism was telling a story other than what states were telling, states officials, historians were telling about what is the nature of our political history, and it was usually bad history from Ralph's perspective, and of course I tend to agree with him on that as well. A phrase sometimes uses the court historians, right? The historians who are paid to write the sort of history that the court, that is the king or the regime, wishes to be written. So Ralph wanted to spend much of his career really explicitly going against that official history. Now, on the issue of war, this was all the more important because, as Lou Rockwell once told me, right, the state lies pretty much all the time, but they lie most when it comes to foreign policy because the stakes are much, much higher when it comes to foreign policy. As Charles Tilly, one of the really the premier historians of the state and state formation, has famously said, right, war made states and states made war, because war has been absolutely central to the project of state building and state making. Ralph knew this. And he knew that, as Randolph Byrne said, war is indeed the health of the state. A lot of his efforts were to counter the state's ability to wage war and to convince the public to support war, because that was so essential in implementing and in augmenting state power. So if we are to be involved in any sort of endeavor, any sort of battle of ideas that claims to be opposed to state power, we really have to take a very close and skeptical look at the state's foreign policy and all of its claims for the necessity and righteousness of war. And so here I'm just going to highlight a couple of ways that Rako, in his writing, tried to address these issues. There are many ways that he does it, just in terms of highlighting certain historical facts and all of that, but there are a couple of things that wind through a lot of his work. And one of these is really rehabilitating our history, that is the history of those who oppose state power and favor freedom and free markets, rehabilitating those who were active in that tradition and made a lot of excellent arguments against state power in war. These are, of course, the people that we now call classical liberals, but which Rako would have called just simply libertarians or just simply liberals. And so we'll go through a lot of the highlights that Rako tried to raise in these two areas, so that we have a better sense of what our roots are, as well as some of the arguments that were made over time. And this is necessary because in the 20th century, so many efforts were made to divorce the modern parties of freedom and free market from their historical roots and to create this idea that you can at the same time have this incoherent idea that, yes, I'm for freedom and free markets, but I'm also fine with a huge surveillance state because that will only be used against the bad guys. And I'm fine with the suppression of liberty by the regime almost always and everywhere because otherwise they'll invade us and strip of all of our freedoms. So the state functions to preserve freedom, even though in reality it's doing exactly the opposite. And it's this, it's these claims that you can have both a huge and powerful state and still preserve freedom that was something the early liberals appreciated and understood, and that was why they opposed the state so much. So let's look at a little bit of the narrative that Rako created there, just so we can get a sense of the sorts of people he favored and what he likes. Now, he considered this ideology, what he called liberalism or classical liberalism, libertarianism, that absolutely central to that project was always opposition to war and militarism. They weren't pacifists. They recognized that there were times that defensive military action needed to be taken, but so rare was this actually met in terms of its requirements, in terms of justification, that of course they were accused by their opponents of being unpatriotic and robbing the state of its essential powers that were needed to wage war. Nevertheless, if you called yourself a liberal in the 18th and 19th century, it was assumed that you were generally opposed to war and militarism and took a far more peaceful view of things than were the old absolutist kings, than were obviously the socialists, and just generally all of the parties that supported nationalism and state power. And he notes out that this was simply the dominant position, and that even the milquetoast liberals of the period, like say British Prime Minister William Gladstone, these people were forced by the success of liberalism to put peace up front and center in their political programs. Rako writes, quote, "Extolling peace has characterized the classical liberal movement from the 18th century, at least from Turgot, on through the 19th century to even Gladstone, who wasn't frankly that much of a liberal. His slogan in mid-Victorian Britain was peace, retrenchment, and reform." So this is a major ruling party political platform. It puts peace first. There was a reason for that. A lot of it was due to the success of the liberals in that time period. The pro-peace liberalism that was the standard at that time, it came to prominence through Richard Cobden's Manchester School. And Rako was a big fan of Cobden, considered Cobden to be certainly one of the greatest minds in international relations in the 19th century. It's also popular in France through scholars such as the radical liberal editors of the political journal Le Censeur Européen. At the top of every issue of that journal was the phrase Paix et Liberté, that is peace and freedom. And so everywhere we look, this is a central concern of these liberals. And the more radical they were, generally the more they opposed the state and its militarism. Among these journals' editors, that is in the French school, was Charles Dunoyer, a leading figure in the French school, and he was also a close ally of Charles Comte, not to be confused with Auguste Comte, the socialist. And Comte was the son-in-law of Jean-Baptiste Say. They were very much at the center of this sort of thinking. And like most liberals of the time, including those of both the United States and Britain, Dunoyer opposed standing armies. This was a key part of liberalism as well. He wrote, "What is the production of the standing armies of Europe? It has consisted in massacres, rapes, pillages, conflagrations, vices, and crimes, the deprivation, ruin, and enslavement of the peoples. The standing armies have been the shame and the scourge of civilization." Unquote. Similarly, Dunoyer's views were reflected in the writings of Frederick Bastiat, who sought to abolish France's standing army altogether. Bastiat's quoted often among conservative sources and other right-wingers, but they never mention his extremely radical views on militarism and foreign policy in general. In an 1847 pamphlet titled The Utopian, Bastiat reminded his readers that military expenditure is generally an enormous waste of money and that the exploitation of the taxpayers could be greatly reduced or the size of the French military drastically reduced as well. Specifically, Bastiat sought to abolish, quote, the entire army, unquote, with the exception of some specialized divisions, which would have to be staffed, naturally, with volunteers, since Bastiat, of course, also sought to abolish conscription altogether. Bastiat sought to replace the state's army with a militia of private citizens in possession of private arms. As Bastiat put it, quote, every citizen must know two things, how to provide for his own existence and how to defend his country, unquote. This idea of more locally controlled militias of private arms ownership, in this Bastiat was, of course, echoing American sentiments from the late 18th century. In the United States, opposition to militarism took the form of vehement opposition to a centralized military force and an American standing army. This was the whole point of the Second Amendment, noting with all that language about a well-regulated militia, that was to be not something controlled by the central government. That was to be locally controlled. Now, obviously in America too, the lack of direct taxation at the time made funding a large military very difficult as well, and we see that as it turned out in fact. As liberals like George Mason made clear, the military power of the U.S. was to reside principally in the private ownership of arms at the local level. And culturally, Americans of the 19th century regarded federal troops with high levels of suspicion. While it was considered laudable to serve a stint in the volunteer militias, Americans regarded full-time federal troops as shirkers living off the government dole. And if you consult, there's a great book by a British historian named last name Cunliffe, and he tries to get into the culture of American views of the standing army and full-time military in the 19th century. And there are lots of anecdotes in there from people like Ulysses S. Grant, among other people, talking about how grand he thought he was riding his horse down the street in uniform, at which point a street urchin came up to him and made fun of him for being so lazy and not getting a real job. So this was a common view at the time. And James Madison, of course, his views were similar. According to Rako, quote, he wrote of war as perhaps the greatest of all enemies of public liberty, producing armies, debts, and taxes, which were the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few, unquote. Moreover, Rako shows that Dunoyer's views were typical of the liberal, the industrialist school. This was important. This was one of the more radical schools of liberalism at the time, and they pioneered liberal exploitation theory. And a lot of people forget that it was the liberals who pioneered this idea that one class exploits another. Of course, from the liberal view, it's the one class is the state and its friends and the rent seekers, and they exploit everybody else. The tax consumers, the tax eaters, exploit the tax producers, the tax payers. And this was seen as very important in our calculation of war and militarism, because war was one of the most effective ways by which the regime, that is the tax eaters and its friends, weapons producers and so on, could exploit those who did actually all of the hard work and the production of wealth. And Rako notes pro-peace was central to the industrialist point of view. Their attack on militarism and standing armies was savage and relentless, unquote. Herbert Spencer, a British liberal who was also highly influential in the United States in the late 19th century, can also be included among those who subscribe to this industrialist point of view. With Spencer, state warfare was a remnant of the past and destructive of both freedom and economic progress. Rako sums up Spencer's view this way. Spencer believed that warfare was suitable only to mankind's primitive stage. The Western world, however, had long since left the stage of militancy and entered the stage of industrialism. War in the contemporary world was retrograde and destructive of all higher values. Earlier in his career, back in 1848, Spencer maintained, as the Manchester School did, that wars were caused by the uncurbed ambition of the aristocracy. Aristocracy being included among the exploiter class by many of these liberals in the 19th century. They were, of course, the ones who wanted taxes, tariffs on food, because they were the landowners and the producers of bread, essentially. And that was one of the great victories of the liberals of the time, was the undoing of the corn laws, which were the taxes on bread. And this is one of the most amazing things that the British liberals did in the 19th century. Nevertheless, the reference to the aristocracy here by Spencer was a common sentiment among the classical liberals, who saw the state's obsession with war as a characteristic of the absolutist and anti-liberal states of Europe. Rako shared this view, noting that in the pre-liberal world, most people were simply pawns to be manipulated for the benefit of the central state and its agents. According to Rako, quote, in 1740, Frederick II of Prussia, called the Great, probably because he was a mass murderer, plunged the world into war. Afterwards, when they asked him why, he said, because I wanted to be talked of. It was possible in this world before liberalism and capitalism to talk of war in those terms because liberalism and the liberal ideology had not yet made war into an awful thing, unquote. The tradition of the ruling classes treating war with a capricious attitude was the norm before the rise of liberalism in the 18th century. The great French liberal Benjamin Constant, of whom Rako was a big fan, notes this attitude among the rulers of the ancient world. As Rako puts it, Constant believed that, quote, the ancients, the Greeks, and the Romans, for all their achievements, were basically societies that were founded on war and on constant war making, which included, of course, imperialism and plunder of other societies. Unquote. These societies did not understand the value of markets and voluntary exchange as the liberals do, and thus these societies constructed their value systems around war, conflict, and force. As Constant himself puts it, war therefore predates trade. One is wild impulse, the other is civilized calculation. The Roman Republic without trade, without letters, without articles, having no internal occupation other than agriculture, and always threatened or threatening, engaged in the business of uninterrupted military operations. Unquote. Ludwig von Mises also identified the ancient preoccupation with war when, in his book Liberalism, Mises directly contradicts the Greek Heraclitus, who had declared that war is the father of all and the king of all. Rather, Mises writes, knowing, being quite familiar with this quote, that, quote, not war, but peace is the father of all things. Rothbard himself, of course, echoed these sentiments in his history of the post-war American right. He remembers the realization at the time, and speaking in his youth, when he suddenly noticed that warmongering, as he put it, was not hardly a modern invention. Rather, the modern militarist consensus of the Social Democrats and the conservatives after the Second World War, quote, was a reversion to the old despotic ancien regime. He continues, this old regime was the old order against which the libertarians and laissez-faire movements of the 18th and 19th centuries had emerged as a revolutionary opposition, an opposition on behalf of economic freedom and individual liberty. Jefferson, Cobden, and Thoreau, as our forebears, were ancestors in more ways than one, for both we and they were battling against a mercantilist statism that established bureaucratic despotism and corporate monopolies at home and waged imperial wars abroad. Now, of course, for more on this and Rothbard's view on that and the importance, really, of remembering the 19th century view, the liberal view of war and militarism, I would recommend Rothbard's book, The Betrayal of the American Right, where he talks about how the American conservative movement then turned things on its head by essentially stripping the Party of Freedom and Free Markets of its foreign policy elements and welding them onto instead these more traditional imperialist views that had existed before liberalism. And it went right up until the early 20th century, is important to note, because the timing is important, as we'll see in the second part here. Certainly one of the most famous strikes against America's turn toward global militarism, as illustrated by the U.S.'s war against Spain in 1898, was the work of William Graham Sumner. Sumner, an influential classical liberal and Yale sociologist, delivered a lecture at Yale in 1899 titled The Conquest of the United States by Spain. The title was a play on words, given that the U.S. had, in military terms, smashed the Spanish military. Yet Sumner feared that it was actually the U.S., or at least the quickly expiring anti-war sentiments of Republican America, that had been defeated in the war. Rather, Sumner contends that the Americans had abandoned the restraint of laissez-faire liberalism in favor of, as Rako puts it, the grandeur of empire. This would be attractive to those who delight in state power and prestige. As Sumner notes, it comes with a price. Quote, war, debt, taxation, diplomacy, a grand governmental system, pomp, glory, a big army and navy, lavish expenditures, political jobbery, in a world, imperialism. Now, of course, many Americans like all that sort of thing. They like feeling that somehow they are part of this great, powerful thing that is the American state wrongly thinking that they have some sort of power over that and that that power cannot be turned against them. But we might then ask ourselves, well, where did all that go? Why did the liberals lost out? Clearly, very few people. I mean, I only quoted some of the more moderate stuff here. We could dig up far more radical stuff from Spencer and from Cobden in terms of their views on the state and its foreign policy. How come we don't hear much about that anymore? And it's significant that that seems to stop after the early 20th century. And this brings us to the second part of Rako's work on that, which is we see wound throughout much of Rako's work is his work on propaganda. And that it is in the early 20th century, and he would say that the turning point was with World War I, that the states of the world, especially the major global powers, engaged in a far more exhaustive and detailed and well-funded program of war propaganda, beginning with the First World War. And so it's not like there was just this even-handed, free and easy debate over ideas. It was that after the triumph of the liberals in many ways during the 19th century, the state regrouped and came back with a huge and sophisticated propaganda effort determined to undo what success the liberals had had. And they were amazingly successful at it. And it's notable, however, that this program began not in the United States, although the United States has certainly adopted it, but it began in Britain, where, of course, the liberals had made some of their greatest gains over foreign policy and over domestic policy as well. So as we go through some of these propaganda tactics, note that the U.S. did not invent these tactics. Over the past 100-plus years, however, perhaps no regime was more innovative than the British when it came to inventing facts designed to manufacture popular consent for wars and more foreign intervention. The United States has done its best to adopt similar methods, however, and creating invented narratives in service of the regime's foreign policy goals is now standard. It's standard procedure for the American state as well. So let's look at some of this. So as Rako notes, the First World War, I think, is where we can really look to see its birth and the rise of its great expansion in terms of volume and sophistication. So obviously, throughout history, most great powers throughout the world have long lied to buttress their war efforts. Right? I mean, we can find countless examples throughout history, but these efforts greatly increased in magnitude during the 20th century, mostly with the assistance of increasingly centralized organs of mass media. Rako suggests that the true turning point was with the First World War, with the British regime, and with the help of media. So getting media into the game was important as well. And the British regime engaged in a propaganda campaign of impressive effectiveness. Specifically, Rako posits that modern wartime propaganda began with, quote, the Belgian atrocity stories of 1914, which was maybe the first great propaganda success in modern times, unquote. The stories of which Rako speaks were part of a concerted British campaign to wildly exaggerate German aggression in Belgium and to send the message that the Germans were a barbaric race, unlike the civilized French and British people of Europe. And keep in mind, right, we've been so colored by World War II propaganda that even the Germans of 1912 are somehow colored by that. But the reality is, of course, the German regime had nothing to do with all of that Nazism stuff. In fact, as many of our audience knows, it was actually the suppression and the destruction of the older German regime that created that power vacuum that brought in the National Socialists. And that's why some of this propaganda is just so ridiculous in its attempts to make the Germans look just so incredibly barbaric. Of course, Churchill was at the forefront of a lot of that, always referring to the Germans as the Hun, as if they were still the raiding hordes of the 5th century or something. And so what were these Belgian atrocities, right? I mean, it was overwhelming in the amount of information that came out through the media and the British regime. And most of it was based on an official British government report known as the Bryce Report. This report made countless unsubstantiated claims about mass rapes, children with their hands cut off, violated nuns, Canadian soldiers crucified on barn doors, and more. This produced horror, of course, and anti-German zealotry around much of the world. But there was a problem, Rako notes. It was nearly all lies. Rako writes, what is the story of the Belgian atrocities? The story is that they were faked. They were fabricated. They were phony. The pictures were photographed in particular buildings, which are known in Paris. The stage sets were designed by designers of the Parisian opera. The stories were made up out of whole cloth and spread by British propaganda as another weapon in the war, especially in the war for the minds of the neutral countries. This turns a good deal of public opinion against the Germans, unquote. And this is, I include this, it's a little off topic, but I include because it's so typical of Rako's honest scholarship too, and even-handed as well. In his discussion of this stuff, Rako talks about some work done by historian Thomas Fleming, not the Chronicles editor, a separate historian, but he notes that Fleming, to his credit, mentions that the real cases of people, including children with their hands cut off, occurred not in Belgium, but in the Congo, beginning in the 1880s at the behest of the Belgian king, Leopold. Because of their great extent and nearly incredible cruelty, it's those that deserve to be called the Belgian atrocities. One great thing about Rako is he doesn't fall into the trap of, yes, the Belgians were kind of pawns in this, and bad things weren't really happening to the Belgians. He uses that as an opportunity to just point out horrible things that the Belgian state did somewhere else. And really that all of this self-righteous talk that you would get from Belgium and their allies, the British, you see them in a very different light when you recall the larger history of the Belgians and the British. One of my favorite Rako jokes is when he talks about how part of the way that the British justified their intervention in the First World War, which there was no need for them to become involved, was that they would say, oh, we're supporting Belgium because Britain always sticks up for the smaller, less powerful nations. And Rako's joke was, he said, and as soon as someone said that in Parliament, someone in the back yelled, what about Ireland? And at which the point the person who said that was taken out into the street and shot. So always a nice even-handed analysis you can expect from Rako on these matters. But nevertheless, the British regime, you can see why they were so desperate to do all of this. They needed the Americans to intervene in the war on their side. And the British spared no expense in this. Rako notes that, quote, ingrained bias of the American political class and social elite was galvanized by British propaganda. In 1914, the Royal Navy cut the cables linking the United States and Germany. Now news for America had to be funneled through London, where the censors shaped and trimmed reports for the benefit of their government. Eventually, the British propaganda apparatus in the First World War became the greatest the world had seen to that time. Later, it was a model for the Nazi propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. So he wrote in an essay called Children with Their Hands Cut Off, or the German equivalent of that, just noting how in awe he was of the German propaganda campaign and that much of Nazi propaganda was based on similar methods. And Rako quotes Philip Knightley, who notes, British efforts to bring the United States into the war on the Allied side penetrated every phase of American life. It was one of the major propaganda efforts of history, and it was conducted so well and so secretly that little about it emerged until the eve of the Second World War, and the full story is yet to be told. So, of course, over time, then the Americans, they're learning all of these methods, and they more and more become the leading party in this as we go through the post-war period into the 20s and 30s and into World War II. And in America, so there was so much agreement, of course, from the ruling class there that it's really quite amazing. The British propaganda effort worked in the United States, and the government enthusiastically entered the war on the side of Britain. This went against what most of the U.S. population had really wanted, but the British had won over the elites to their side. And they were so effective that even as the British effort mounted, the Republican Party's leadership went over and started to pressure Wilson into taking a harder line against the Germans. And as Rako puts it, quote, Americans who devoutly wished to avoid war had no spokesman within the leadership of either of the major parties, unquote. And we know all about that nowadays. Now, once the U.S. entered the war, the U.S. implemented its own propaganda barrage And it did a lot of this, of course, through the public schools, and it started engaging the other side of propaganda, which is outright censorship. And Rako notes, public schools and the universities were turned into conduits for the government line. Postmaster General Albert Burleson censored and prohibited the circulation of newspapers critical of Wilson, the conduct of the war, or the Allies. The nationwide campaign of repression was spurred on by the Committee on Public Information, headed by George Creel, the U.S. government's first propaganda agency. Just one example of the regime's capture of educational institutions could be found in how the New York Times praised the president of Columbia University for dismissing faculty members who opposed the regime on conscription. So these are tried and true methods, and apparently it seems to always involve Columbia University as well. Now, the Second World War brought another resurgence in war propaganda, and this time American cooperation with British forces was virtually guaranteed ahead of time. By 1939, Roosevelt was already promising to King George VI that he would provide full support for Britain in case of war. Now, even in 1940, even before the U.S. entered the war, the U.S. government was working hand in glove with the British government to convince Americans of the necessity of U.S. involvement in the war. And this was even covered up for decades afterward. Rako notes, quote, in 1976, the public finally learned the story of William Stevenson, the British agent codenamed Intrepid, sent by Churchill to the United States in 1940. Stevens set up headquarters in Rockefeller Center with orders to use any means necessary to bring the United States into the war. With the full knowledge and cooperation of Roosevelt and the collaboration of federal agencies, Stevenson and his 300 or so agents intercepted mail, tapped wires, cracked safes, kidnapped, rumor-mongered, and incessantly smeared their favorite targets, the quote-unquote isolationists. Through Stevenson, Churchill was virtually in control of William Donovan's organization, the embryonic U.S. intelligence service, you know, later the CIA, essentially. Churchill even had a hand in the barrage of pro-British anti-German propaganda that issued from Hollywood, a perennial partner in this, in the years before the United States entered the war. Gore Vidal, in his book Screening History, perceptively notes that starting around 1937, Americans were subjected to one film after another glorifying England and the warrior heroes who built the empire. As spectators of these productions, Vidal says, quote, we served neither Lincoln nor Jefferson Davis, we served the crown, unquote. Vidal was so impressed, in a bad way, by the continued success of British propagandists in his effort that he later remarked, quote, for those who find disagreeable today's Zionist propaganda, I can only say that gallant little Israel of today must have learned a great deal from the gallant little Englanders of the 1930s. The English kept up a propaganda barrage that was to permeate our entire culture. Hollywood was subtly and not so subtly infiltrated by British propagandists, unquote. And this goes on for a number of years, with the U.S. ever taking on more and inserting its own interests separate from British interests, and of course going on into the Cold War and beyond, well beyond the Second World War. And of course, how did they do this? It was, of course, through media, through Hollywood, but also the schools were on board. Rako writes, back in 1948, Charles Beard already noted the dismal ignorance among our people of the principles of our Republican government. American education from the universities down to the grade schools is permeated with, if not dominated by, the theory of presidential supremacy in foreign affairs, coupled with the flagrant neglect of instruction in constitutional government. This propaganda has deeply implanted in the minds of rising generations the doctrine that the power of the president over international relations is, for all practical purposes, illimitable. Who would even question that now? And this is certainly no recent thing. This is one of the many great uses of Rako's work, is seeing just how hardwired into American education and American political institutions is this idea of the executive state and its elective wars, and that all of this can be done at any time by simply the ruling regime with virtually no sign-off from the American public. And this has now just become well-established pattern of American life. And it's always assisted by elite journalists more and more. Rako notes, Truman's campaigns, that is basically his Cold War campaigns, his campaign to launch ever more international presence throughout the world, could not have succeeded without the enthusiastic cooperation of the American media. Led by The Times, The Herald Tribune, and Henry Luce's magazines, the press acted as volunteer propagandists for the interventionist agenda, with all its calculated deceptions. The principal exceptions were the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Times Herald in the days of Colonel McCormick and Sissy Patterson. In time, such subservience in foreign affairs became routine for the Fourth Estate. And of course, as a result, once you have the media on your side and you're actively suppressing during wartime alternative voices, voices in favor of peace were shouted down and banished from the public discourse. And Rako quotes Stephen Ambrose, who notes that by the time Truman left office, a whole new view, right? We were never going back to the old pre-World War II idea of anti-intervention. Ambrose says, quote, "When Truman became president, he led a nation anxious to return to traditional civil-military relations and the historic American foreign policy of non-involvement. When he left the White House, his legacy was an American presence on every continent of the world and an enormously expanded armament industry. Yet so successfully had he scared hell out of the American people, the only critics to receive any attention in the mass media were those who thought Truman had not gone far enough in standing up to the communists. For all of his troubles, Truman had triumphed." And so we all know now how this pattern works. It's, we get the same thing, right? Be afraid, be very afraid, let the president handle it. Here were all the elements of manufacturing consent that we would be employed during the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the arms races of the 60s and the 80s, the new regime change wars of the post-Cold War world. And we barely see even any real change in the narrative and the strategies that, that go on today in recent American wars. And in this, we see, we find the answer perhaps in all of this trend to a question posed by Rako during one of his lectures. He says, "Isn't it funny how, with the possible exception of Vietnam, all of America's wars have been justified and have been right and good? I mean, what are the odds of something like that? A major power's every war has been good, and the enemy has always been unbelievably horrible," unquote. He already knew the answer about how this came about, right? It was the state's propaganda that made it possible for Americans to believe that virtually every new war is some kind of crusade against evil. Thanks to propaganda, the American thinking on foreign policy, which in an earlier age had been pragmatic and less moralistic, had taken on its modern tone of quasi-religious righteousness. So we can now, of course, contrast this with the earlier narrative that Rako talks about, that is the 19th century liberals who understood the role of the state in the destruction of liberty and that this was closely tied to the issue of war and militarism. And of course, there are many other ways that Rako has contributed to the issue of revisionism, a lot of other topics that he talks about and really should be investigated, I think. But in these two ways, I think, are two of some of the main pillars of the way that he gives us new ways of thinking about American foreign policy, or just foreign policy in general, as well as the history of ideas and that war over ideas that has been so essential in limiting the state and its wars. It wasn't just some accident that so many Americans now believe, that so many Americans abandoned the anti-interventionist views of a century earlier. It was a concerted effort to destroy what the liberals had accomplished. And so today, I think it's important that we look into this, that we understand it, that we know something about it, and I think that will give us a lot of the help that we need in taking the narrative in a different direction and really fighting the state in this war of propaganda that they have been fighting so successfully so long, and which many people don't even know exists or are unaware of its level of sophistication and just the sheer volume that is produced day in and day out. So if you have any questions about Rako, come ahead and see me afterward, but I guess it's about time for lunch, so thank you very much. Thank you.